Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who has the right to decide how and when you will die? While some Americans believe assisted suicide offers terminally ill patients a dignified alternative to a long and painful death, others feel equally as strongly that it is always wrong to help another person speed the arrival of death and worry that legalizing the process opens a Pandora's box of potential abuses. Just two states have laws allowing doctors to assist terminally ill patients with suicide, but as my guests today have learned, the lack of legislation has not kept patients from seeking help to end lives that have become too painful or incapacitating to bear. Miri Nevasky and Karen O'Connor are the directors, writers, and producers of the new documentary, The Suicide Plan. It airs tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television as part of the PBS series Frontline. Karen and Miri, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks, Chris.
How did it come to your attention that there were a significant number of patients in states all across the country looking at least to explore their options for assisted suicide?
Well, Mary and I had done a few films for Frontline in the last several years on the territory of death and dying. And last year, our last film was called Facing Death, which was inside an ICU unit and a bone marrow unit at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. And in that film, we were looking at the prolonged death and dying that comes in the wake of medical advances in the last 20 years. And in some ways, it's the opposite theme of this film. In that case, people were fighting to live. And in this film, we're looking at those who are choosing to die and those who help them. So in some sense, Chris, it was the natural extension of it. Mm-hmm. And also Frontline had some interest in revisiting territory that they've covered. And also, you know, kind of heading to almost 20 years since Oregon became the first state in the country, it seemed like a good time to go back into this territory, but to go back in what we hoped was a kind of new and provocative way, which was going inside it through those who are kind of helping others to die.
But just to add to that, I don't think we were aware of the extent to which people were finding ways to do things. We had, read a story every now and then about someone being arrested for assisting in a suicide, but we did not know the extent to which there were organizations that were willing to help people outside of those states until we started to research the subject.
Talk about the concerns that patients have, first of all, with the idea of natural death when they are suffering from certain kinds of illnesses, and then the things that they worry about that could go wrong if they don't have some assistance or guidance in the event that they choose to end their own lives.
Well, I think in our experience, one of the things we're really surprised at is that the things that people worry about the most, and I think in Oregon where they've done studies on this, we always kind of assumed that people were worried about pain, mm-hmm. and that I think it turned out that people were much more worried about loss of autonomy. Isn't that right, Karen?
Yeah, that's right. Loss of control and autonomy.
That was a much bigger fear across the board by people. I think with kind of advances in medicine, you know, most often with especially in places with big palliative care programs, the kind of pain and suffering can be handled, but it's autonomy and even the fear of losing control that I think were people's biggest concerns. And then, as one doctor said to us in other films that we did, it's not so easy to kill yourself. It's hard, and it's not just taking a pill, and it's not just overdosing on things. I think things can go wrong. So I think many people are afraid that they'll end up worse off themselves if they try to take it into their own hands.
But I think the kind of iconic image of people's greatest fear and what drives much of this is that kind of attached to a ventilator, unable to kind of speak, the kind of prolonged, awful death, I think, is the kind of nightmare image of the bad death that people hope to avoid, I guess, with the idea of this option at least.
It was very interesting to me, at least from what we see in this film, this is not something that it appears patients or their families are inclined to do on the spur of the moment. Tell us a little bit about the process of deciding when they might choose to end their lives and how many patients actually go through with it after exploring these options.
I mean, I think it depends on, you know, the organizations or the individual, so I'm sure it varies a great deal. I know that one of the patients that we had met through Compassionate Choices said that I think something like 50%. We had also heard 1 in 100 end up going through with it. From what we saw, there's a very lengthy process, and that many people don't end up actually using the lethal medications in the end. And I think that's true in Oregon, again, where they've done all these studies where people, it's something about getting access to that stuff that is the relief. I think we met with a number of different patients, some of whom never ended up, you know, died a more natural death without ever taking the medication themselves.
And in each case, I mean, I think Compassion and Choices, for example, that helps June Butterstein in our film, they have their eligibility requirements and their admission criteria and those kinds of things. And I think those are in place also to make sure there is this kind of waiting period. Because in every case, whatever the method of death, I think it takes considerable resolve, no matter what, to actually end one's life. And so, as Mary said, I think very few people in the big scheme of things actually do it. But it isn't that kind of impulsive suicide that one thinks about in other cases. It is certainly a different kind of issue. In many cases, people are dying already, not necessarily all those in our film. So it does still take some serious kind of reflection to do this.
So let's talk more about this organization, Compassion and Choices, that you've both mentioned a couple of times. What sort of help can they offer to patients looking to end their lives?
I mean, I think they offer a wide variety of help, so it is certainly not limited to that. And it's everything from, you know, counseling type of help to palliative. Most of what they do, I think, is explaining to people what their options are. And so they, you know, it's anything from stopping a medication to stopping eating and drinking, which is kind of one of the ways that it's really in your control to end your life. But they do also counsel people, as we show in our film, about lethal medications, where you can get them, how you can take them. And I think they, in very specific circumstances, again, as Karen said, with their eligibility criterias and you have to be terminally ill and you have to be enrolled in hospice and they have a whole list of, you have to be, you know, mentally competent, a whole list of criteria before they will work with you.
They are I think they are the leading right to die advocacy organization in the country, and they are the group that was behind the legalization efforts in Oregon and Washington and across the country. And then they have, though they publicize it, their clinical program, as it's called, which offers this kind of end-of-life consultation service, is not as well known even within the Right to Die movement. Though I think they try to be straightforward about it, there are elements of it that are clearly lesser known. And then the other group that we look at in the film is called Final Exit Network, which is a more radical offshoot of Compassion and Choices that split off in 2004. And largely because the dividing line within even the Right to Die movement over who should or shouldn't get this kind of assistance, and Final Exit Network will help patients that Compassion and Choices may not, and that's largely non-terminal, the chronically ill, the really complicated cases such as Alzheimer's and degenerative diseases, and Final Exit Network will help those people.
Right, and Final Exit, the title comes from the name of a book that was then made into a DVD that offered people a range of options. So Final Exit Network, they don't necessarily draw the line between the intolerable pain of, say, a physical illness and the intolerable pain or incapacitation of a mental illness.
That's right, Chris. They believe, I mean, their line is suffering to some degree. Now they have also their, you know, they have their
criteria.
Mm-hmm. But their line would be drawn very differently from Compassionate Choices and others within the Right to Die movement as well, wouldn't you say, Mary?
Yeah. I mean, I think even within mental suffering and, even within the organization, I think there's a lot of differences of opinions about who would qualify and who wouldn't, and is it, you know, a consistent 30 years of suffering or, you know, I think part of the issue that we saw is there are a lot of different lines for a lot of different people. So when there is no legalization, it starts to fall into these organizations and they create the protocol. But then if it's lots of different people, they each can tend to draw their own line. So I think in one of our cases, it was okay by the medical director, but it wasn't okay by the person that was actually assisting. But, you know, so things start to break down differently.
And it gets really complicated, Chris, because as you know, from certainly what we explore in the film, even if physician-assisted suicide were legal in every state in the country tomorrow, that would the only people that qualify under those criteria of those laws are the terminally ill.
With 6 months or less to live.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So there's still this other vast part of the population that would never kind of be answered in terms of confronting these issues, even if it were legal everywhere in the country. So it gets more and more complicated the deeper you go in.
It is such a complicated question, and I found myself thinking a lot after the film about why, and I think you can ask this question of yourself regardless of where you fall on this issue, why it is that, for example, some kinds of pain and suffering, people find it much easier to imagine that it would be okay for a patient to choose to end his or her life than other kinds of suffering, even if neither one offers much hope of relief.
No, it's true. I mean, Mary and I, even just in the course of the filming, you find yourself, you know, find ourselves swinging back and forth and kind of navigating it through ourselves because it's pretty complicated. We're just as you said, whichever side you're on, a proponent or opponent or wherever it is, I think the film at its best kind of takes you from these theoretical abstract arguments and you kind of imagine yourselves in these various situations, and very few of us are kind of immune from it. And so one way or another, whether it's, you know, a family member confronting kind of withdrawing some kind of life-saving treatment or stopping dialysis or coming off a ventilator or terminal sedation in hospice, you see us all struggling one way or another with these kinds of big and important last resort questions. And I guess assisted suicide is, in some ways, it's at its most dramatic. But in some ways, we all are kind of confronting this.
And, of course, the law has to confront it as well. You open the film with the story of a man named John Wells who was suffering from advanced cancer, chose to commit suicide, had a gathering of friends sort of wish him goodbye, asked for help, and then the last person who was with him was charged with second-degree manslaughter.
Yeah, that's right. In some ways, it's the classic iconic case. You know, it's two New Englanders, two friends. John Wells was 66 years old with advanced prostate cancer that had metastasized, and fiercely independent guy who decided to live under those terms was not living in his mind. So his good friend Hunt Williams appears at his door one morning, and he's asked to kind of help him get ready. And John does it in a kind of classic, iconic way, which is to shoot himself. And Hunt is there that day, helps him clean a gun, and stands kind of with him. Walks away but is nearby when John kills himself, and he's charged, yes, just as you said, with second-degree manslaughter for assisting in the suicide of John Wells and faced potentially up to 10 years in prison and was no more prepared for that than I suppose anyone else that we look at in the film. But those are the risks. We have these laws almost everywhere in the country that prevents us, any individual, from helping another end his or her own life. And so what we look at in the film and the larger themes are those laws, though, reflect our greater ambivalence about what to do.
Let me jump in. We'll take a break here. My guests are filmmakers Mary Novaski and Karen O'Connor. Back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Filmmakers Karen O'Connor and Miri Nevasky are my guests. They wrote, produced, and directed the documentary The Suicide Plan, which airs tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 television as part of the PBS series Frontline. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Steve, who writes, as much as the fear of the loss of autonomy for me is the fear of leaving huge bills to my family. Is that something that you heard from other patients that you spoke with for making this film?
We really didn't so much hear the financial concern. We heard a lot about people not wanting to be a burden. So I guess that is, in some ways, the biggest burden you can be.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we didn't. Did Karen?
No, in the story, it's definitely, we certainly have read in our research that can be a concern that Steve mentioned, but in the stories that we followed, no, it really wasn't the thing that was driving anyone's choice.
This is an interesting conundrum for loved ones as well, who obviously hate to see a loved one suffering, don't want to say goodbye, but try in many cases to respect the wishes of someone who wants to end his or her life. And yet, because of the lack of laws and because of the possible legal liability, they have to do things that almost feel dishonest sometimes after a loved one has taken his or her own life.
Oh, I think that's right. I think it's one of the things that I find kind of really moving and a different kind of heartbreak in this. It's true. And in one of the stories, Joan Butterstein, an 82-year-old woman from Littleton, Colorado, who's dying from lung cancer, she has her 92-year-old husband, Art, is a devout Catholic who personally doesn't kind of approve of taking one's own life or assisting in a suicide. And you see in the film his struggle to kind of be loving and supportive of his wife and make this decision. And then you also meet her daughter, who talks very movingly about kind of what they've learned from Compassion and Choices about who to tell and who not to tell. But there is this extra layer of secrecy that Miri and I both kind of responded to in the research of this film. And it's a complicated... It complicates grief even more, but I think it's an interesting element to all this. You're dealing with it, but you also deal with these potentially illegal things that certainly, if not illegal by the letter of the law, it feels kind of dark and secretive.
And you can't be open. I think it is. It is even for Joan herself. I think as Karen said, I think it has to complicate the grieving for those left behind. And I think even for Joan, for example, she couldn't tell her hospice people, who she was incredibly close with, for fear of either jeopardizing them or jeopardizing her own plans or for, you know, numerous different reasons. But I think it's complicated and very, very sad.
And it seems there are multiple cases of people being considered sort of accomplices to suicide in states where it's illegal, despite the fact that the patient who has initiated the process leaves behind pretty clear evidence of his or her intent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we're all struggling. The laws that we have are very vague. They're as Karen said, maybe, you know, it's hard to tell what the reasoning behind them is. Is it to stop malevolent assisting? Is it to stop any sort of assisting? But yes, I think it's you know, with Hunt Williams, the story that you mentioned in the beginning of the film, he cleaned a gun and he helped him carry it outside. That was all he did. And so most people look at that kind of line of physical assisting. Was he physically involved? And different places draw their own different lines as to what is assisting. Is helping them grind medication assisting, or is it actually the putting the medication to their mouth? Is that what assisting is? I think it depends on whether a prosecutor wants to prosecute, and it's not, you know, I think those lines are very, very blurry.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with filmmakers Karen O'Connor and Mary Novaski. Their documentary, The Suicide Plan, is on Frontline tonight. You can watch it on Channel 13 at 9 o'clock. We have Howard on the line in Dallas. Hello, Howard.
Hello, how are y'all doing?
Very well, thank you.
The reason why I call is that one of my favorite authors, Sir Terry Pratchett over in the UK, he did a documentary on assisted suicide. And I believe if I'm going to sit there and go through severe pain for the rest of my life with no chance for a cure, I would rather go that way than just to suffer until finally the disease takes me.
Yeah, he did a very interesting film where he kind of followed people to Dignitas, where they left, you know, to Switzerland, where they could, you know, go and they take a lethal dose of medication. It's legal there, so people travel into that country. And he followed around a number of different people who were choosing to do that to look at what that process was. We really decided to focus on what's happening in the United States, in the states where it's not legal. But it's definitely an interesting, beautiful film.
The one thing that it seems everyone would want to avoid is any possibility that a person might feel compelled by external forces to do this. Are there people exploring ways that it could be absolutely possible to ascertain that something is entirely the choice of a patient?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think it's one of the things I find interesting in the film is we've included Dr. Timothy Quill, who had his own experience in the late 90s when he, as a physician, prescribed a lethal dose of medication to a terminally ill person. And he talks about the kinds of dangers and risks of activists being involved in this issue. Everyone talks about that. I mean, I think even within the organizations, they'll all say they're trying to avoid any kind of even implied pressure. You know, Compassion and Choices and Final Exit both sort of say and remind people that this is always their choice to the very end. But it's a pretty interesting question. I'm not sure there's data on it per se, but there's certainly something instinctual that everyone worries about. And Tim Quill, as an advocate himself, raises some interesting questions about precisely the dangers and risks of this staying underground, is that those checks and balances that you might have in an open system get lost. So in some ways, by this staying secretive, it poses even greater risks than it might otherwise. So it's an important and interesting question, Chris.
Tell us a little bit about the Jana Van Voorhees case, which has a lot of sort of unanswered questions remaining.
Yes, yeah, she was a woman. She was a 58-year-old woman who had called Final Exit Network for help. And essentially what you do is apply there as not a patient, but a client, a member of the organization. You apply to be a member of the organization. You write in. You have meetings with people who go, and her, and she never submitted any actual medical records. So she was approved without anybody actually seeing her medical records. And I think she's precisely what Karen is talking about in terms of some of the dangers of it being underground. And in the case of Final Exit Network, many times they will help people, and sometimes people don't want their families to know. So that's another problem, I think, with it being underground, is a lot of times it's people who are alone, and there's no family members around who know them well over a long, long period of time to give context to what they're suffering from.
Her case was even more problematic because she's also turned out she wasn't terminally ill or even really gravely ill. It turns out she had psychiatric mental illness. She had psychiatric issues and was mentally ill. And so her case within the film certainly represents, it comes towards the end of the film, but the proverbial dangers of the slippery slope. The cases throughout the film start in some way with the most straightforward and then get more and more complicated. And I suppose force us all to grapple with the complications as the film progresses. But hers is a real challenge in that way. And I think the film also, though, explores just what we were talking about earlier, Christie's murky laws, because though you look at her case on the surface of it, you'd think, oh, Final Exit might clearly get prosecuted, might get convicted for that case. But the jury hearing that trial ends up hanging on the case for a number of reasons. But it's an eye-opening look into the kind of dangers of how these things can kind of move along in ways that nobody really kind of had expected or wanted.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phone now. We have Jane on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Chris. Ambivalence is really the word for this whole issue. A couple of weeks ago, you had the pet ethicist, Jessica Pierce, and mm-hmm. I called in my seeing eye doc. I had to put her to sleep last week, actually, so I didn't have much time with her. Mm-hmm. But the process was so gentle, and I knew it was absolutely right for her. And I keep thinking, boy, why can't we do that for ourselves? And I just found out that my favorite aunt who lived in Oregon, when it was her time, she chose that assisted suicide. And the family was very, and she was very at peace about that. And the third thing is, I'm Catholic. I have a lot of ambivalence about it. I'd like the option, but I don't want to go to hell. And the fourth thing is, I don't think Texas would ever vote assisted suicide to be an option in our state.
Well, thank you so much, Jane. I'm sorry that you've been through so much. I really appreciate you sharing your stories. And Karen and Mary, wrapped up in Jane's statement and her stories and her is just a lot of emotion and a lot of conflicting feelings about this. In some ways, she sort of typifies, it seems, people who are grappling with this issue.
I think she does exactly. That's right. And in one person, you can feel these kinds of all of these emotions at the same time. And I think that's one of the reasons that Mary and I thought that this might be a useful way in, because it's exactly that. It's one of, like lots of other social issues that we all confront, it's enormously complicated and full of contradictions and ambivalence and certainty and fears and all of it in one bundle. So it's certainly one of those universal issues that we all are kind of grappling with.
I was thinking as well about physicians in states where this is not legal. It is, I think, for many of them, heartbreaking to lose a patient, especially to a slow and debilitating illness. It must, in some cases, be heartbreaking to have to say, no, I'm sorry, I can't help you, to a patient who really wants assistance with this.
Oh, I'm sure. It's doctors are put in very hard positions now. I mean, I do think there are a lot of other ways that they can help, but I think that they're, as Timothy Quill was told us, it's scary for them. You can lose, your license. You can go to jail. You can, he had story after story for us. So I think it is very complicated for physicians.
But we also found in the course of filmmaking that I think to a person, very few people ever discussed it with their physician.
That's true.
It was really interesting. They, in some cases, it was generational. I think they didn't want to embarrass the doctor. They didn't want to put them on the defensive. In other cases, they knew it was illegal and wouldn't. But almost to a person, nobody really had any kind of straightforward conversation, but that's because we're dealing in states where it's illegal, so that's probably not so surprising. But even the hints and the winks and the nods, which we've been told by other physicians that this goes on, but it goes on quietly and secretly, and that it's an interesting fact that very few people even feel comfortable even broaching the subject with.
Yeah, most people were getting on the internet, and also I think people don't have those relationships a lot with their doctor anymore. They don't have the old family physician that they turn to that knows them well, and so I think people are even more reluctant.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Tom is on the line now in Dallas. Hello, Tom.
Hey, good afternoon. What a sensitive subject, and to your guests, too. I want to thank John for doing this film. I have a couple of nuns that lived to be 90 and 84, and they've loved my brother and I for 56 years, but the last 7 years was really, you know, with Alzheimer's, it was really rough to see them suffer. And, of course, the Catholic Church wouldn't allow anything like this. But they were very intelligent. One of them was the head of Covenant House, and she had 39 honorary doctorates and 3 PhDs in child psychology. And it was just, you know.
Yeah, I'm so sorry for your losses, Tom. And Karen and Mary, it does seem people... again, as Tom is expressing, you can absolutely not want to see someone go and yet feel certain diseases have stolen who they were away from them. What about people who are in the early stages of some kind of dementia? In Oregon and Washington State, is there a provision for them to make an advanced request for this sort of thing?
I think it's under discussion, but those provisions don't exist yet, and so it adds another dimension of kind of heartbreak to these decisions for sure. It's in our film, we look at the case of George Brodigan, an 82-year-old retired attorney who, when we kind of come into his story, he'd been diagnosed 4 years earlier with vascular dementia. And it's a story that takes you into kind of that heartbreak that Tom faced with his family. And in George's Brodigan's case, he knew he had to potentially give up time. He was nowhere, kind of, he hadn't lost competency certainly, but he knew the dangers of waiting too long. And that window of opportunity closing, because you have to be mentally competent, I think, to make this decision. And certainly as far as his son and family was concerned, they wanted to know and be sure that it was his decision. So, but in that case, he had to be willing to kind of die sooner, probably. And that's a terrible bargain to have to wrestle with in its own right.
Karen O'Connor and Mary Novaski are here. They are producers, writers, and directors of the new documentary, The Suicide Plan. You can see it tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 Television. It's part of the PBS series Frontline. We'll come back to the discussion in a moment and invite you to join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Mary Novaski and Karen O'Connor, the filmmakers who produced the documentary The Suicide Plan for the PBS series Frontline. It will air tonight at 9 on KERA Channel 13 Television. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Lynn in Grapevine, who writes, "After being diagnosed with terminal liver cancer, my dear friend intended to travel to Oregon for death with dignity. His dying proceeded with unexpected speed, so the option wasn't there for us. However, to those who say there should be no assisted suicide, my answer would be that if you're already dying, there is no suicide involved, only the timing and control of the end. People who commit suicide don't want to live. People who choose death with dignity want to continue living, but cannot." Did you want to respond to that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a big issue in the right to die world is actually the language, the word suicide, and a lot of people don't equate the ending of one's life, especially if they're terminally ill, with suicide. They say it's more for it suggests somebody is mentally incompetent or not. I'm not sure that I agree with that. That it's just the intentional taking of one's life. But I guess the question is, I'm not sure what the...
There wasn't really a question. It was just a statement. And the idea that people who are choosing to die this way, it's not that they are necessarily wanting to die if the health situation were better.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think nobody wants to die. I think that's probably correct. But it's the hastening of a death in a lot of ways, and for people who don't want to live under the conditions that they're living with anymore. So that's definitely true with that condition. Karen? Anything to add to that?
No, I mean, she's right. It's a distinction that, as Mary said, matters very much within the right to die world. And in all those ways, we agree with the basic premise. Our job as kind of journalists and for Frontline is to just kind of go in and report what that is. And in our case, we're looking often at these kind of legal lines, and people in our film are facing potential charges of assisting in a suicide. Nobody's charged with assisting for aiding and dying. So it's a particular angle of vision that we're focusing on in the film. But Lynn's larger point is certainly true. These are people who, in many cases, not every case in our film, but in a number of cases, they are wanting to control their own dying.
Right.
But that's not true with John Selmer in our film, and that's not true with Jaina Van Voorhis. And so the issue gets even more complicated when you move this forward for people who aren't actually dying. Then what? What do we do as individuals? What do we do as physicians? What do we do as a society? And that's where it gets even more complicated.
Yeah, and it was interesting in terms of language. Every person that we met had their own language that they, whether it was aid in dying, death with dignity, suicide, self-deliverance,
The death event.
There was all this lingo around the same act. So we found it interesting.
Do you think it's possible that the reason that more states have not ruled on this, made it possible even in very limited circumstances, is because we really don't, we can't account for every possible contingency, every possible circumstance, which would make it, in the eyes of many more people, either okay or not okay?
Yeah, I mean, I think Karen and I found that as we were going. It's the lines. It's so case by case.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the arguments opposing it is, can you ever really say with, you know, certainty that somebody's dying within 6 months? And where we draw those lines, there's always going to be a little uncertainty in it. And yes, you're never going to be able to account to all the people that a case that might be not, you know, that might feel as if it's an okay case. So I don't know if that's the main reason, but I do think that must be in the mix somewhere.
The two states where it's passed, as you probably know, Chris, it's been ballot measures where citizens have voted or not voted it in. Massachusetts came pretty close last week. It was a 49-50 percent defeat in a state that's still, you know, heavily Catholic. But I think also there, it's just exactly that fear that you described. I think that's where the hesitation is, one way or another, and it comes close when it's. Those are, and ballot measures are the only states where it has been enacted, and even then you find that the public remains kind of divided.
And even in these cases, it's just hard to legislate. I mean, even in cases where they have these assisted suicide laws and they're taking the people who, quote-unquote, assisted Jaina Van Voorhis to court, that jury was totally split. Even on what is assistance and where do you draw the line, and it just didn't matter, her mental illness, did it matter or not? It's just every time you talk, it just comes right down to the middle. So I think you find that ambivalence, even in states where it is an illegal act. One of the things that we were surprised about is in every case, even though charges were brought, it never went anywhere. It was, we are so ambivalent about the issue, especially when it's being driven by some sort of compassion. It's very hard to prosecute people for this.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like people recognize that this is different than sort of garden variety manslaughter, but it's hard to say exactly how and why in a way that is cut and dried.
Yeah. No, and you prosecute it still as if there is this law. Can they really just ignore it? But even when they do, as Mary said, they try to plea a way out of it, or special probations, and yet we have these laws on the books for some purpose, we all assume, but it's true, all the way along the line, the laws themselves, I think, are vague and keep this conundrum going to intentionally aid or assist someone in the taking of one's own life. And often, as Mary said, that comes down to physical help, but what exactly is that line? And so it's on it goes, in case after case, and you may be interested to know that Final Exit Network, which was charged in that Jane of Van Boer's case and another in Georgia that also ended up not going to trial, was just charged a short time ago in Minnesota and faces manslaughter charges for assisting in the suicide of a woman there. So that's supposed to go on in the spring. We'll see what happens with that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jeff on the line now in Dallas. Hello, Jeff.
Yes, Jeff from Dallas. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
More of a comment and then maybe an observation. As one who obviously respects that which is being said, I have a mother who suffers from Alzheimer's and has for a number of years, and the great difficulty, obviously, that comes with her and her health, and obviously my father is the caretaker, and the burden that is on the family, I certainly am one who sympathizes with those who are suffering and go through struggles and so forth. But from one who comes from a biblical worldview, we believe that life is sacred. And I think often when man has the ability to end life and to take life, it can do away with the sanctity of life. And we believe, most of us, or many of us here in the Bible Belt, Bible-believing Christians, believe that even though that person suffers, that there are other lessons that are being gleaned from those around. And so while I respect the discourse and the dialogue that takes place, I believe that life is sacred, and it is something that's special. And even through suffering, life can teach us, and even death can teach us that process. And I'd be interested to hear your comments.
Thanks so much for your call, Jeff. I appreciate it.
I think, I know exactly what Jeff is talking about, and Mary does too. In the film, we look, for example, at John Selmer, who decided to end his life, Jeff, without his wife knowing. His wife, Sue, was a devout Christian herself, and she found out through a number of circumstances were kind of unfolding in the film that he died by with help from Final Exit Network, this group. Her grief was even more complicated precisely because she's a devout Christian, and this was, in her mind, against everything she believed in and believed her husband believed in. So it's a point of view that we try to represent in the film through Sue's story and a couple of other moments, but it's definitely a legitimate and important argument that animates much of this debate.
The film did cause me to think about whether or not, given that this is so underground in so many cases, whether or not we might all know someone whose life has ended this way, and that fact has simply been hidden from friends, from loved ones, from neighbors, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things Karen and I found during the course of making this film is how many people knew somebody who had done this, and it was, it had done some version of something. Someone said to us, "It's the whole thing reeks of abortion before it was legal. It's kind of, you know someone who knows somebody, you find out they did it, you find that person, and that there is a similar quality to it." So yes, but I think we were astounded by how many people, even without assistance of others, quietly with doctors or with family members or through organizations, had kind of found their way to help.
You mentioned at the top that you have both worked on films that dealt with the issues of death and dying in the past, but I wonder if you could speak to the challenges of finding people who were willing to be candid with you about what they experienced.
I mean, I think Joan, Karen could probably talk about it more, but Joan was amazing. I mean, Compassion and Choices really helped us to find, to go through They have a lot of people who come through there, and we worked with our counselors for an extensive period of time, kind of meeting with people and, you know, seeing if this was something they would be interested in doing. In some ways, this film, it was different. The last film, I think, the people who tend to do this are people who are really in control of their own lives. And as Karen said, you have to have real resolve. You have to have real determination. So they were people who knew themselves very well and very quickly seemed to say yes or no to us, you know, early on with great determination. And a lot of them, it was an important political issue. So
There was, however, I think, concern in both cases, certainly Joan and another and some other family that we followed, about family members and about the potential risks for them. And that was a concern in almost every case in the Butterstein, Joan Butterstein story that we followed. Joan is very careful and very secretive, also largely to protect her family, but also wanting to adhere pretty closely to these legal lines that she feels, that she learns from Compassion and Choices, and that she feels and hopes will protect her family. And that's a, and those that will keep them on the right side of the law. And we found that in case after case with family members who did kind of very generously agree to participate. But there was also an awareness of potential risk at every turn.
I won't ask about your conclusions with regard to the issue itself, because you're very careful in the film not to take a position. But I am curious as to whether you sense that it would be that patients who are considering this would prefer that it be out in the open, whether that would make for them the process of making the decision easier.
I mean, I think without a doubt. Just to be able to talk to your family about it, you know, I mean, in some cases, I suppose it's trickier. Jane of Anvoris, for example, chose not to tell her family, as did John Selmer. So I, you know, in those two cases, that was a choice on the part of the patient. So I'm not sure that would have made a difference to them. Although maybe the illegality of it all adds to some shame. I don't know.
I certainly ended up, wherever you are on the issue, again, whether you're for or against it, I kind of landed where I think at one point Dr. Quills talks about it, that if you're going to be dealing with something this complicated and where the stakes are so high, then I do kind of, I definitely landed that where all of us could be doing better than this and would be much better off with an open secret than this secret system. I mean, I think that's it. Even if we're pushing at the limits and even if it has to be debated and whether even the debate goes on, whether it should be legal or not, I think it's, I think some kind of openness is better than what's happening with this. People flailing and kind of figuring it out on their own in this weird, wacky world.
The new documentary by Karen O'Connor and Mary Novaski is called The Suicide Plan. It airs tonight at 9 on Channel 13 as part of the PBS series Frontline. Mary and Karen, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. It was a real pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. Email comments to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.